www.dickgordon.org.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and we'll start this hour with a pop quiz. Can you identify this movie star just by the sound of her voice?
You'll try in vain. You can't explain the charming, alarming blonde women. They fascinate. They captivate. Beware the amazing blonde women.
Marlene Dietrich may be the mother of all amazing blonde women, and now in what would be her 100th year, she is still attracting audiences, as she would put it, like moths to a flame.
Be careful when you meet a sweet blonde stranger. You may not know it, but you are greeting danger.
And you'll be meeting Marlene Dietrich today, both the person and the product, the Marlene Dietrich she created. Connection listeners, what do you think it is about Dietrich that still fascinates? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, join us online at theconnection.org. And if you do today, you'll find a gallery of photographs of Marlene Dietrich there, which you can flip through as you listen to our program. Now, joining us today are a couple of people who know Marlene Dietrich so well they can probably lip-sync her movies in English and in German. We'll get to them in just a moment. We'll begin in the studio with Klaus Eder. He is a film reviewer for the German daily Handelsblatt and for German Public Radio. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Now, you're here in Boston to speak at the opening of a big Dietrich Film Festival sponsored by the Goethe Institute and Boston Public Library. There's also a big photo exhibit. But I want you to talk to me about the gift that Marlene Dietrich got posthumously from the city of Berlin on the 100th anniversary of her birth, which was just a week ago. Is that right?
That's right. And the relation between Marlene Dietrich and Germany and Berlin is a very, very complicated history, starting in 1930 even. Marlene Dietrich was born in Berlin. She grew up in Berlin. She even spoke the very typical Berlin dialect also in her songs. She was a known actor, singer in Berlin of the 20s when Joseph von Sternberg discovered her for The Blue Angel. And on the evening of the premiere of the film, on the evening, she went directly from the cinema hall to the United States. She went to Hollywood.
She was 29 years old.
She was 29 years old at that time, and Joseph von Sternberg had engaged her with the Paramount Studios in Hollywood. And a German star leaving Germany and continuing its career outside in Hollywood, okay, it was not too well seen. Then in end of the 30s, 39, she took the American citizenship, which again led to some polemics against her in the German press of the time.
Well, particularly when we think about what was going on in Germany in 1939.
Right. And then happened what spoiled her relationship to the Germans, or from the Germans to her. In 44 and in 45, she returned to Europe, to France, to Italy, and then to Germany, as a colonel of the American army, singing for the GIs on the front line.
Had the Germans ever asked her to come back to be a part of the Nazi information machine?
Of course. Hitler himself, and in particular his minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, offered her to come back to Germany to continue her career there.
And now, she said no, but did she say no for political reasons,
reasons,
professional reasons?
No, she said so. At that time, she said very clearly no for political reason. She returned to Berlin for a show on the stage in 1960, and this caused in Germany a big scandal. There were flyers, Marlene, go home. She was. There were anonymous letters accusing her to be a traitor of the country. And it was said that as a result of her singing on the front lines, thousands of German soldiers have been killed. So it's her fault.
So what happened this past week to cause people in Berlin to change their minds, to issue the apology?
The past week started already in 1990 or 1992, after the fall of unification. Where all the estate of Marlene Dietrich, after her death in 92, went to the Berlin Film Museum, and the Berlin Film Museum started to make a permanent exhibition of Marlene Dietrich. Then, some years ago, the old center of Berlin, the Potsdam Place, was rebuilt, and there's a big place called after Marlene Dietrich.
But when the mayor and the president say, "We are sorry you were mistreated. You did the right thing back in the war years." Are they speaking in a kind of formal government way, or are they expressing a sense that Germans feel that perhaps Marlene Dietrich should be repatriated even after her death?
I think this reconciliation was done from the German public 10 years ago, and this is now a kind of formal and official excuse of the German government, of official German politicians, saying to her that you are welcome back to Germany.
We're going to be joined now from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee by Patrice Pitreau. She's a professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has a chapter on Marlene Dietrich in her new book called Aftershocks of the New. Welcome, Patrice.
Welcome. Thank you.
And also Mary Desjardins, assistant professor of film studies at Dartmouth College and one of the organizers of Marlena at 100, an international conference which took place at Dartmouth just a couple of months ago. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
So why have a conference 100 years after the birth of Marlene Dietrich in the United States? What is it about the woman that still lasts, that still mesmerizes?
Well, one of the things that we were struck by when we were trying to organize the conference was the fact that we could potentially invite people to come and give papers from all kinds of disciplines, people that would talk about Weimar Germany, that would talk about Nazi Germany, that would talk about American culture in the 1930s, that would talk about the relationship between film as a media versus live performance. And Dietrich is the star that fits into all these categories.
But
you can talk about all these things.
She's not an obscure object of film studies. She's also still known, still viewed, still loved and admired.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those of us in film studies want to probe why certain figures are popular. So, in fact, for us, the fact that she still is known is what makes her such an exciting figure.
Now, Patrice, when you spoke at that conference, you talked about the inner thighs of Marlene Dietrich. Do you want to explain that?
Well, what I was trying to speak about, it was an example from her film The Blue Angel that launched her career. It was shot simultaneously in German and in English. And von Sternberg, who was an American director who went to Berlin to make the first sound film in Germany for a very famous actor, Emil Jannings, he was the one and discovered Dietrich in the process. Well, what I was trying to say with Dietrich's inner thighs was that in the German version, she lifts her when she sings Falling in Love Again, sitting on the beer barrel in the Blue Angel cabaret. She lifts her in the German version, her left leg, showing her inner thigh. Whereas in the American version, which was shot simultaneously, she raises her right leg. So, you know, without showing her inner thigh, just the outer thigh. And my point was that the image of Marlene Dietrich, who is incredibly modern, which I think is some of the reason for her continuing influence today, that image is very much part of Berlin culture in the 20s, which is wider, too. I think it was part of New York culture as well. And that it was kind of airbrushed for American audiences. And that's really, we get the semblance of her, this kind of Berlin culture that I so much admire in her films in the 30s and 40s. But it's kind of tamed. No inner thigh, only outer thigh. It still remains, but in a muted form. That was my point.
And this difference between the English version of Blue Angel and the German version, you also can see in the song Falling in Love Again, which
Absolutely.
In the German version is a little bit more saucy, more fresh, impudent, while the American version, Falling in Love Again, is a little bit more romantic. And for the rest, you are, of course, right. I mean, Marlene Dietrich was in midst the Berlin, the big, living, vivid culture of the 20s, late 20s and 30s, and this is a part of the cultural background which made her what she was.
And Mary, I mean, it's an interesting way of looking at the distinction between the American and the German cinema of that time, but it also draws us into the conversation about Marlene Dietrich and sex, because she did with sex on screen and on stage some things that hadn't been done yet.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think it's interesting that both, you know, Patrice and Claus are talking about this kind of sexual sophistication of Berlin, which had to be tamed down for Hollywood, and that's true. But even in that taming down, Dietrich was able to find ways, along with her collaboration with von Sternberg, find ways of suggesting a kind of perverse sexuality that sometimes in its mere suggestiveness was actually more thrilling, more mysterious, could be more titillating. Kenneth Tynan had a wonderful quote about Dietrich. He said that she had sex without gender. There's a way in which she exudes sexuality that defies certain kind of gendered categories. And that was evident even in her American films that were trying in some way to tame down that sexuality that was more explicit in the Berlin context.
Patrice, I remember a film professor pointing out to me in slow motion that moment in the film Morocco when Marlene Dietrich makes her way through the bar kissing not just the men but the women as a particularly remarkable moment in film at that time.
I think that she wasn't certainly the first to have this kind of, you know, this sexuality and, you know, hints of lesbianism and all the rest of it. I don't think it's that she was first. And in fact, I mean, I agree with Mary, but I would only add that what I so admire about her films and about her persona is that she was enslaved neither to an ideology of love nor to one of sex. So she was not a sex object. She was a quite knowing sexual subject. I don't see her as so perverse as simply sexuality as part of life, which I think, again, makes her very modern and very interesting to a lot of people still.
And I suppose, Klaus, it was also part of her German presence in America at that time, which would raise people's interest in her as a screen symbol.
In spite of the fact that the Blue Angel was premiered in the States only after her first American film, Morocco, but you should also see that the roles Marlene Dietrich played were always, not always, but I mean her main roles were always made to underline, to support this image. She played singers in nightclubs, she played prostitutes, she played thieves, and by the way, I think that it was Joseph von Sternberg who absolutely made this role of hers.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the magic of Marlene Dietrich. Do you have any recollections of ever having seen her perform, or perhaps the first time you saw her? 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
With your let's get more than friendly design, I should be brave and say, let her know more of it. But oh, what's the use when you know?
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. And perhaps if there was any one piece of music, anything from that time, it was Lili Marlene that both American and German soldiers were listening to in their foxholes.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lily Marlene.
That's got to take you somewhere. Where? I want to know. 1-800-423-8255. Give us a call with your thoughts about Marlene Dietrich. And we're talking about the unbelievable, enduring nature of this particular actor. My guests are Klaus Eder. He's film critic for the German daily Handelsblatt and for German public radio. Mary Desjardins, assistant professor of film studies at Dartmouth College, and Patrice Pitreau is professor of English and film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Patrice, this relationship that she had, that Dietrich had with von Sternberg, who was really in charge? Who was making the image of this woman?
Well, I agree with Klaus that, yes, of course, von Sternberg, who was a consummate artist and had, you know, really knew how to paint in light, had a lot to do with creating her image. But I think what's really fascinating is that she was incredibly interested herself in the craft of film. I think when you talk about, you know, this enduring legacy, and one thing I hope we can get to in the course of our discussion today, hopefully, on the one hand, it is this manipulation of her image on film through lighting techniques, and which is attributed to von Sternberg, who was an incredible artist. That's definite. But there also, I think, is the quality of her voice. Remember that she becomes a star of cinema at the moment of its transition, at this very turbulent time. In both politically with the Great Depression, but also in terms of the coming of sound to the movie. So she's, you know, and the very fact that we're on the radio and you're playing songs that were broadcast on the radio, that she had a radio show, that there's a quality to her voice. Before we went to break, you said something about, you know, the fact that she was German in America allowed her a certain latitude. I think that's true. I mean, in American movies, if there was ever going to be a menage a trois in the early, you know, 30s, late 20s, you had to go to Europe. You had to stage the action in Europe. This couldn't happen in the U.S. So there was something about, you know, this kind of sexy German, heavily accented. But it also, I think, has a very particular resonance with, as I said, this 20s Berlin culture with a kind of Berlinese dialect that carries throughout her songs. And I think we need to talk about Dietrich not just as this incredible image sculpted by von Sternberg, but also as the voice, very distinctive, and also, I think, transgressive of certain typical gender stereotypes.
Mary, let's hear from you. The voice, the image, what is it for you?
I would agree with Patrice about the voice, but I'd also like to add something about the degree to which she collaborated with costume designers. This was also a very important part of her image. When she started at Paramount, she was able to work with a fabulous costume designer, Travis Banton, who was the one of the in-house Paramount costume designers. And she worked very closely with him in creating costumes, and even though von Sternberg had something to do with that, with his films, he tended to be very autocratic and wanted to be involved in every aspect. She and Banton worked very closely on, you know, applying feathers, where the feathers would go on the costume, where the beads would go, and this continued throughout her career, working very closely with costume designers. She was one of the first public figures, at least that had visibility in the United States, that wore Dior's clothes in the post-war, post-World War II period, the new look. She popularized that in America. And then in her international concert performances, she worked with the costume designer Jean-Louis in creating some dresses that were almost scandalous. They were designed in such a way to look like she was wearing practically nothing except a few strategically placed bangles and beads. We tend to think now of, you know, stars like Jennifer Lopez and Madonna coming on the Grammys or other kinds of shows in shocking clothes. Dietrich was doing this a long time ago, and she did it throughout her career. And she was very conscious of the fact that she was creating a product and that she could package herself in a particular way that would make her appealing to audiences.
So, Klaus, in your view, who was in charge of this of the image? Was it this wonderful collaboration of a woman who had all these skills and von Sternberg?
Well, first you should know that Marlene Dietrich was a very hard worker. She was a perfectionist. She prepared herself very well. By the way, in her private life, she was a very typical German housewoman who loved to cook, and she even cooked for her lovers and all that. And the profession was the profession. And she didn't only cooperate with the costume designers and others, also with the cameramen concerning the light. And particularly in her late films, she knew better than the cameramen where the light has to be put and so on. I think that, okay, to be a little bit polemic, Sternberg was a kind of animal trainer who took her as a kind of object. He made a certain image of her, done by masks, by decoration, by costumes, by all that. And I think she obeyed him. She was a Prussian girl, so she was drilled to obey people. And I think only...
But she also knew what was going to work for her.
Of course. And but I think that after both separated, Sternberg and Dietrich, she took her own fate much more in her hands than before. I think she intentionally made less films. She made around 55 films, but made less films and started that new career of a singer. And I agree totally with what was said before about her voice. Hemingway said once that if she wouldn't have nothing but her voice, this voice would break hearts.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Have you ever had your heart broken by the voice of Marlene Dietrich? Carol's calling in from Boston. Carol, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell you a personal anecdote about meeting her. I was in the army. The war was over in 1945 in Germany. I was going with three other guys in a jeep to Nice on furlough. And we were going down the Autobahn and past the army command car with gas cans strapped on the front and back. So we knew they'd been coming from somewhere along far away. And we stopped at a Red Cross Clubmobile to get coffee. The car pulled up, a bunch of colonels, and this one woman in USO uniform got out. And I thought everybody recognized her. It was Marlena. And I thought she was beautiful and very sexy.
You must have thought you'd died and gone to heaven. Come on.
Well, let me tell you the rest of it. She was very nice. She posed for pictures with those of us who had cameras. I had a $12 Argus my father had sent me. And that's my only claim to fame. I have a picture of me and Marlena with her arm around my neck. And we got back in our jeep later on and went on our way. And one of the guys said, "Say, who was that old bag?" The difference between 20 and 44, I guess. And anyway, I thought she was beautiful. That's all. It was just we later learned that she was coming back from Berlin from the funeral of her mother, who stayed in Berlin all through the war.
Interesting relationship that she had with that city, with her family, Klaus.
Yeah, and her mother lived indeed there all the war and the period after the war.
Lived with all the criticism of Marlene while she was away.
Marlene first was very cautious, and she didn't make any kind of open political statement against Hitler, just to protect her family being in Berlin. But Marlene had a very big feeling for her family, and she took also very much care of her daughter and later on the family of her daughter. This was one, again, of the Prussian traditions, to be in charge of family and a part of family. She married in 23, I think, a production designer called Rudolf Sieber. And in spite of all her affairs later on, and in spite of all what happened, she never divorced from him, and she helped him until his death in 63 or 64. So she was this kind of German woman who loves the family, who loves her mother, and who does everything to protect the family.
All right. Carol, thanks for your call. Our number, 1-800-423-8255, from Carroll County, New Hampshire. Anton is joining us.
Good morning.
Hi.
I loved her characterization of Lily Marlene and singing Unter die Laterne, but I found myself in seeing Die Blaue Enge greatly disturbed by von Sternberg's characterization, where the school teacher is totally humiliated and degraded. I assume that's Jannings.
Yes.
And
was that Mary or Patrice? Sorry.
It's Patrice.
Patrice, go ahead and speak to Anton about this characterization.
I wanted to just continue a second.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I find, you know, myself as equita to see the degradation of the school teacher, and I assume that's von Sternberg's take on it, but that really turned me off. But finally, I wanted to ask you, in terms of her greatness in film, to draw a comparison between Dietrich, who prospered after the fall of the Third Reich, and Leni Riefenstahl, who misused her talents to cooperate with the Third Reich, but was put in the deep freeze forever, and who really made an enormous contribution as a woman to film art. So that's what I wanted to ask.
Patrice, I'm going to get you to just speak to the characterization that Anton began with.
Right, right. No, I think that one thing that you need to know, Anton, about Emil Jannings, who plays the role of Professor Roth, is that he had a long, his kind of character image was playing these degraded, humiliated male figures. This wasn't the first time. In fact, he was very famous in a 1924 film, The Last Laugh, directed by Murnau. The film that he won an Oscar for, the very first Oscar for Best Male Performance, was right before that he made with von Sternberg, The Last Command. Same thing, same humiliated male figure. I guess when I see The Blue Angel, and I've seen it and teach it regularly in both language versions, in the German language version, I think their relationship between Lola and Professor Roth is much more complicated. She clearly loves him in some way, has maternal feelings for him. And I think it's in the English language version where, because so much has been excised, largely because of the problem of language, scenes are not, you know, are cut or there's not a lot of dialogue. The relationship between this younger woman and older man becomes more pathetic in the English language version than in the German version, where I actually think it's quite complex. Reviewers at the time remarked on how she was, you know, really brought pure bliss to this man's otherwise very authoritarian, lonely existence. So I think it can be read in different ways. And I think it's important for the listeners to know that Emil Jannings, I mean, that was really his persona in the movies.
Mary Desjardins, perhaps from you on the contrast in the way that we look back now at Marlene Dietrich and Leni Riefenstahl, who was the brilliant filmmaker propagandist for the Third Reich, and as Anton quite correctly says, disappeared after that.
Yeah, well, Leni Riefenstahl presents some problems from film history in terms of how do we deal with her. There are some film historians that, you know, want to claim, you know, that she was a great artist and it shouldn't matter really what her subject was. But it's very difficult to get around the fact that she was using her great artistry and, you know, incredible, especially her eye for editing and mise-en-scene in her documentaries about the Third Reich, that she was using that to promote the Third Reich. It's sort of difficult doing a direct comparison because Riefenstahl, of course, was a director, though she had started out as an actress. But we primarily know her today as a director, and Dietrich, of course, was a performer. So it would be hard to know if for instance, Riefenstahl had stayed a performer, what we might have thought about her in comparison to Dietrich. So I find that a little difficult to answer, though, you know, Dietrich, as we've been saying already in this program, and we said at the beginning of the program, has had, you know, this conflicted status in terms of what she means to Germans today. So neither figure really escapes these issues of contradictions in terms of their politics around the Nazi era.
And that's a very small difference between Leni Riefenstahl and Marlene Dietrich. Leni Riefenstahl, as an artist, never left Germany. Later on, she made a career as photographer, but hadn't any chance to continue working in Germany after the war, while Marlene Dietrich had the whole machine, worldwide machine of Hollywood.
Okay, Anton, thanks for your call to West Roxbury, Massachusetts. And Adam, you're on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
Good. I'm from Boston Latin School. And last year in my German class, we saw Der Blaue Engel. And one of the things we discussed is if they ever had to do a remake of this, you know, who would direct it? And my friend predicted that Neil LaBute would do it, just kind of a random guess. And it turns out in the paper, the next day in the paper, there's going to be a remake of it, and Neil LaBute is going to direct it. But the first thing that pops up in my mind is, who would ever be able to capture the magic of Marlene Dietrich now? What actress? And I was just wondering if any of the guests would guess as to who would possibly be able to fill the role of Lola Lola.
Mary, do you want to track that or tackle that one?
Yeah, that's tough. There actually was a remake of The Blue Angel in the late 1950s that was directed by an American director, Edward Dmytryk, who was one of the original Hollywood Ten. And I believe it starred My Brit, and it did not do well at all. It was a American production that actually was filmed over in Germany. Neil LaBute is probably a good choice in that he also specializes in humiliation. If we want to talk about the Yawning's character in terms of a paradigm for male humiliation, so LaBute certainly has a tradition of working with characters in which there's a lot of power games being played and a lot of humiliation being dished out. In terms of who could replace Dietrich, that's a tough question. You know, many people have pointed to the fact that someone like Madonna, who has very explicitly referenced Dietrich in her videos and some of her performances, you know, has certain elements of Dietrich in terms of that ability to constantly transform herself, to want to be known as the sexual transgressor. But we all know that Madonna has not had good luck in movies. She's not proven to be a particularly charismatic actress. So I doubt that she would be a good choice for that. And I'm actually at this moment sort of coming up short. I mean, we certainly have someone like Nicole Kidman in Moulin Rouge recently playing the cabaret singer put into these 19th century situations. I'm not sure that she would work either.
Patrice, close. Any nominations?
Yeah.
I would hate to see Madonna play the role. That's
all I have to say. Absolutely. Yeah, I would too.
She has none of the sophistication that Dietrich has.
No.
And I think, she's vulgar in a way that Dietrich was never vulgar.
And I can tell you that we had recently an attempt to make a biography on the screen of Marlene Dietrich. And it was a German actress called Katja Flint who played it, and it was a lousy film because Katja Flint never came to the dimensions of Marlene Dietrich. She cannot be imitated.
1-800-423-8255. Lola, Lola, the woman who can never be imitated. This hour we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Nazi Lola, the wisest girl on earth. At home my pianola, it's worked for all it's worth. Now I'll tell you a secret, don't hammer on the keys. For little pianissimo is always bound to please.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. My guests are Mary Desjardins, Assistant Professor of Film Studies at Dartmouth College and author of a forthcoming book called Recycled Stars, Hollywood Film Stardom in the Age of Television and Video. Patrice Petro is Professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and wrote the chapter on The Hottentot and the Blonde Venus in her new book, Aftershocks of the New. I've got that wrong, Patrice. Correct me. Your book is Aftershocks of the New?
The book is called Aftershocks of the New, yes.
Okay, great. And
I thought you did it quite well, actually.
I just tripped on my own tongue. Klaus Eder is a film critic for the German daily Handelsblatt and reviews films also for German public radio. We'll be introducing Marlene Dietrich from Berlin to Hollywood, the film series, which is beginning tonight at the Boston Public Library for people listening to us in the Boston area. Adam, thanks a lot for your call. Now back to your Latin class or your German class. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Gilly is calling us from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Gilly.
Hi. I just wanted to say that early in the 1950s, Marlena was very much an icon for the gay community in Brooklyn Heights, New York. And they had her own phone number, her personal phone number. So one night they decided to telephone her.
Who's the they who called her, Gilly?
A friend of mine who was gay. And there were several of us listening in. And so they asked her in the course of conversation what she was doing. And she said, well, if you must know, I'm washing my grandchild's diapers. Which we thought was very, very funny.
Now, where was she at the time, Gilly? Because
she was living in New York City.
And even at that time, in the 1950s, was an acknowledged sort of icon for gay culture.
Yes, very definitely.
Did she speak about that on the telephone?
No.
Nobody asked her?
No. No, they just had a real informal chat with her, and she was very nice. But they were really surprised when she told them what she was doing. And I later saw her, right before she fell and hurt her back, I saw her in the Beverly Mass Summer Theater, and she looked marvelous. And that was in the early 70s, and she was quite old at that time.
Well, you're lucky to have seen her. Gilly, thanks for calling in.
Okay.
Gilly calling in from Lynn, Massachusetts. Patrice Pichot, I didn't realize that her attraction to gay and lesbian people went back to the 1950s. I would have thought that was something that came later.
No, it was there from the very beginning, and even in the United States. And I think part of the appeal is that, you know, being gay or lesbian was not a shocking or perverse or odd thing. For her, you know, she saw it as part of life and a kind of level of acceptability that was part of Berlin culture in the 20s, certainly exercised from German culture in the 30s with the rise of the Third Reich. So that even though, as Klaus says, she was a nice Prussian girl, even Prussian girls have their own ways of making sure that they might be under certain constraints, but I think she always had a very open attitude and towards sexuality, and not one that it's shocking or perverse or odd, but that it is just every day. And I think that, in fact, you know, there was huge gay community, a lesbian community in the 1930s in the United States that was very enamored of Dietrich and Garbo and other stars at the time. But I think just as in her strong political anti-Nazi stance and her support of her Jewish colleagues, I think she was also quite outspoken in an understated but understood way about gay and lesbian sexuality.
I totally agree. It's the reason for that is in the German 20s, or let's say in the city of Berlin in the 20s, which...
Specifically Berlin, not the Weimar Republic.
No, specifically Berlin, which was, let's say, a big metropolitan city of the world with a very vivid atmosphere, with a lot of glamour and glitzer, with a high intellectual life. And there were gay and lesbian friendships were not at all strange. So I think the background for this part in her character is really coming, as Petra said, from the Berlin of the 20s.
1-800-423-8255. Daniel's calling in from Somerville. Hi, Daniel.
Hello there. I wanted to make a brief comment and also a brief question. My brother once saw her in person in the 1960s when he was working for Brentano's bookstore in Manhattan. And it was interesting. In the same summer, Greta Garbo and Marlene Dietrich both shopped there. And Garbo was totally private and unobtrusive, and she was barely noticed. Dietrich, on the other hand, really enjoyed her celebrity, even in the 60s, and she was flamboyant and friendly, and she even asked to use the telephone and stretch the phone cord across the entire store so everyone had to notice her.
But she was still performing for 15 years, I mean, up until the mid-70s.
This is the same era where she actually was an anecdote was told about her that she had a whole record album that she made for herself of just applause from her concerts.
You had a question, Daniel.
But here's the question. This may be a little abstract, but I'm wondering if Dietrich is a sex symbol of the 30s, a sex symbol as tease, as cool and self-contained, as someone who doesn't really need men, and I don't think even needs sex. Has any similarity today when sex symbols tend to be all icon and all tease and all distance, and there's something sort of lacking in the earthy in today's music industry in Hollywood?
This sounds like one for you, Mary.
Well, I think Dietrich certainly had that persona in which there was a certain level of indifference At the same time, I mean, this is part of the contradiction, at the same time, she seemed to be, you know, as Patrice has already pointed out, this desiring subject, this desiring femininity. And she desired what she desired without apology. But at the same time, there was that kind of coolness, that indifference. And that works well with the kinds of characters like Yannings in Blue Angel, where the humiliation is to some extent based on these kinds of games in which Dietrich could withdraw, you know, affection or attention. And, you know, to some extent, I'd have to say that that is what makes her modern. That is why perhaps she still interests us today, because it is a modern take on romance and sexuality. And for that reason, I guess I would have to agree with you that you do have a lot of personalities today that have that kind of cynical indifference. But I also don't think you have, and maybe this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of someone like Madonna perhaps being too vulgar. You also have a great deal of vulgarity in a lot of the contemporary personalities, where their sexuality seems to be worn on their sleeve in very obvious ways. I mean, you look at somebody like Britney Spears or something. Who,
you mean,
you know,
leaving less to the imagination.
Right, exactly, leaving less to the imagination. And Dietrich, she could be in provocative situations, but she could also make an ordinary situation seem very sexual, which I don't know that you have, or maybe what we're talking here about is the difference between a kind of vulgar sexuality and a kind of eroticism.
I want to go back to a word that you used, though, Mary, and ask Klaus, because Mary used the word cool. Is that the way we understand cool? Is that the way you understand the character?
It's the way I understood the character and maybe even understand. I remember one scene of a film she made in 1929, just before The Blue Angel, called The Women You Are Longing For. And there's a man falling in love with her, and he brings a lot of flowers, and he says to her, "I'm doing everything you want for you." And she looks distant, cool to him, and says, "Okay, then walk my dog around in the park." This is this kind of cold distance, which you find in a lot of her roles.
Cold, not cool.
Cold, both. Cold and cool, I would say. Impudent, distant. But, on the other hand, this includes also the ability for self-irony, which is one very important part of her character.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to Jim, calling in from King Street, South Carolina. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Thanks
How
for
you
calling.
Doing?
Good, thanks.
That's good. I just wanted to relate a personal experience I had with Miss Dietrich. I was a young banker in New York, and her agent, General Artist at the time, called up and said that she was going to do a show in Vegas and needed a wardrobe, and she needed some financing for the wardrobe. So she came into the bank. We were right there in Rockefeller Center on 51st Street, and we had a huge platform. And right open to the public, she came in. She was very gracious. She didn't wear her celebrity on her sleeve. And I thought she was a beautiful person.
Did you talk to her?
Yes, sir.
Did you fall in love with her?
I certainly did.
And you still watch her movies?
And I still watch her movies. I think she was a tremendous lady. As I said, she was very gracious. She wasn't I wouldn't say humble exactly, but she was just a very nice person.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
To Anya, calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Anya.
Hi, this is Anya from Cambridge calling. Good morning. I would like to make a comment on a remark that was made earlier on Marlene being the typical obedient Prussian girl. Not only do I think that this is a fairly superficial cliche and a misperception of Prussia and the people who live there. I'm from Potsdam myself. I also think that Marlene does not deserve this kind of evaluation at all. I think she did her own thing. She was very disobedient of the leaders of her time, and I just felt that this was completely wrong.
Klaus, talk to Anya.
To state about
Marlene. Do you know, if you are from Potsdam, I'm from Munich, from Bavaria, and we know the classical conflict between Bavarians and Prussians.
I'm likely
okay,
to get a little lost here.
But you're right. I think one of the characteristics of Marlene Dietrich is that she was both. Once asked if she would not have been a star, what she would have wished to become in life, and she said, a husband, children, a home.
Mm-hmm.
And in her personal, let's say, morality, she was indeed a very typical German housewife. On the other hand, of course, she was very impudent. She was made an opposition against a lot of things. I'm not only talking about her political statements, which she did, and her position against Hitler Germany. I'm also talking about the simple fact that she was one of the first who appeared in Hollywood and in New York in normal life in trousers, at that time a kind of scandal. I think also after her films she did with Joseph von Sternberg, she made a lot of provocations on stage, also in her songs. And if you know German, you know that the texts of her songs from time to time were indeed very impudent, very frech, as we say in German. So I think both the opposition and the cliché, both are in Marlene Dietrich's person.
Could I jump in here?
Go ahead.
This is Patrice. I agree with the caller. I mean, I think she was very disobedient, but in the way, again, of seeming to be obedient. She was married to the same man, but they stopped having any kind of what we would think of as conventional married relationship quite early on, certainly by the time of the Blue Angel. In her own memoir, her autobiography, where she says, you know, why should she not be married? I mean, it saved her from having other proposals. It was convenient. I don't see even her conventionality in any way with respect to her marriage. I also wanted to make one comment about an earlier remark that Dietrich wasn't earthy. I disagree with that, too. And I think when perhaps listeners go to see the Blue Angel tonight, you'll see that, in fact, she's quite earthy. I think some of that earthiness was airbrushed in the early 30s films. Not completely, but I think she's quite earthy.
Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Desjardins, Assistant Professor of Film Studies at Dartmouth College. Patrice Petro is Professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And Klaus Haider, thanks for coming in. Klaus is a film critic for the German daily Handelsblatt. And if you're a listener in the Boston area, Klaus Haider kicks off the Marlene Dietrich film retrospective at 6 p.m. tonight. That's at the Boston Public Library. And if you're one of those people who wants to explore the subject further, go to our website at theconnection.org, where we've put together a gallery of classic photographs of the actor. The senior producer is Graham Smith. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Men cluster to me like moths around the flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted. What am I to do? I can't tell.